1968, a man named Austin Wiggin believed that his three young girls, Dorothy, Betty, and Helen, were destined to become big stars. He removed his girls from school, he bought them musical instruments, and with his stern disciplinarian hand, he arranged for music and vocal lessons. The result was a sui generis band called the Shags, who wrote earnest but wildly discordant songs. It's so hard to have to wait for you to try to communicate. The Shags were true originals and true outsiders. If they hadn't operated in this total bubble, would they be as interesting as they are? Or would the Shags be no different from any other 1960s band? Exploited by the music industry? Urged to pump out number one hits? Discarded once a newer and younger band had been foisted upon the public? My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. This is the second of a two-part episode devoted to the investigation of a uniquely American cultural epidemic. We have limitless choice offered by the internet, so why do we tend to gravitate to culture that everybody else likes? If we're listening to mainstream culture, why aren't we using our independent minds to come away with a different idiosyncratic take? Moreover, why aren't we going ahead and listening to things that are outside of our comfort zone? Well, in our last episode, we discussed the problems of cultural engagement with the writer Chiese Lehmann. He pointed to how many of the stories in our culture, especially from regional areas such as Mississippi, are taken for granted. They're often pushed into the background, considered noise, something for us to listen to while we're working or while we're cooking dinner. Well, this episode features a conversation with Alyssa Court, author of Republic of Outsiders. It documents the thin veneer between insider and outsider culture. Today, being a part of culture isn't so much about maintaining an original voice. It's about being liked. It's about courting the corporate forces that are seeking to loot the very qualities that made you interesting and special in the first place. It's about pretending to be an outsider when you're really an insider. These are very important questions, and I was happy to discuss them with Alyssa. If you would like to comment upon this program, you can email me at ed@edrants.com. To listen to this show and more than 500 others, you can go to batsegundo.com, BATSEGUNDO. Please spread the word about this show, because your input through iTunes reviews, social media, Tumblr posts, carrier pigeons, whatever form of conveyance you prefer, all helps to keep this show going. And now, here's Alyssa Court! Okay, so I'm here with Alyssa Court, who's most recently the author of Republic of Outsiders. Alyssa, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Well, let's talk about the book. I did read it, of course, and I want to ask you, I mean, when George Lucas made Star Wars episodes 1-3, he declared himself an independent filmmaker, even though he was self-financing these movies for many millions of dollars. I also remember in 2011 when Zooey Deschanel and Joseph Gordon-Levitt were actually singing, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? And they released this to YouTube. They faced a great deal of criticism. YouTube is the amateur media. Well, now we're in a totally different ballgame these days. Now we have crowdfunding with Spike Lee, Zach Braff, Veronica Mars. And these people say, hey, it's okay. And what's even more astonishing is that people are actually more accepting of this. And maybe just to start off on what we're dealing with here in terms of insiders and outsiders, I mean, why do you think that independent filmmaking has changed so that we now accept these people moving into the turf previously occupied by outsiders and basically people who were scrabbling together various resources to make different eclectic art?
Well, I think right now we're seeing coalitions of insiders and outsiders, you know, in the sense of in a single person. So you have someone like Spike Lee, who is doing a Kickstarter campaign where he may have raised it by now, trying to raise $1.25 million. And then you have, you know, Amanda Palmer raising something similar on Kickstarter, even more. And then you have actual true outsiders or, you know, people who would have defined themselves as outsiders for many years also using these same media, and it becomes, as I write in my book, a republic of outsiders, some which are arguably relying on their fans too much.
Yeah. To the point of exploiting them, as Amanda Palmer is, like, hey, we're going to have professional musicians play for free, which she's received a lot of understandable flack for.
And I just saw recently a Marina Abramovich, the performance artist who had a big show at MoMA,
yeah.
You know, quite famous, a dancer just was complaining about being exploited for her labor in a crowdsourced thing. So even now there's highbrow artists who are getting in on this kind of fan star collapse and also monetizing, people who are non-stars labor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's also interesting because I saw recently Tilda Swinton went to Russia and is presenting herself as a total outsider. Of course, there's her famous exhibit where she basically is sitting there. You know, we're now seeing a situation where mainstream people or people who have dabbled between mainstream and outsider type of art are now feel this overwhelming need to define themselves as a rebel in some way, and yet they're still reliant in many ways upon corporate cash or mainstream sources. I mean, you know, why do you think they're
ordinary people's cash or
yes.
their friends' cash
or their
friends' labor, and in a sense, like the traditional selling out where you're relying on a corporation can start to seem somewhat more innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why do you think that the now identifying yourself as outsider is now a fundamental part of being? I mean, you know, we can all sort of see through it, especially when one tracks the general tenor of some artist's voice, you know? So why is this such a big thing these days, you think?
You know, I mean, originally I was going to call this book either The Maverick Principle or Mavericks, yeah. and then there was the 2008 election, then you had
yeah.
Sarah Palin and John McCain calling themselves Mavericks.
A real maverick, yes.
And then, you know, there's at some point, Obama was even called renegade. So I think it's really interesting. There's a lot of use of language of the rebel, renegade. But again, like part of what I did in this book was I tried to include as many people who I considered, and I use this word advisedly, authentic outsiders.
Yeah.
And as well as people who were this inside-outside thing like Amanda Palmer.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, one piece of writing you don't actually include in the book, but I feel is actually germane to this argument, is Dave Eggers' famous selling out speech, which he gave to the Harvard Advocate. And this, I still see it crop up all the time on Tumblr, where people constantly use this. And he basically says, okay, so the Flaming Lips appeared on 90210, and they performed their popular songs, but who cares? And he basically says that, hey, I take money, considerable thousands of dollars from Fortune magazine, but I'm giving that away. But what's interesting about this, and what no one seems to actually really think about in considering the Eggers rant, is that he's not willing to hold himself accountable for how being indoctrinated in that kind of mainstream situation is going to affect his outsider nature or is actually going to compromise it in some way. And I'm wondering, you know, why this is such a compelling piece of text. I mean, even like almost 15 years later after it was initially disseminated, why do you think people are still, you know, clinging to this notion of being an outsider or, you know, wanting to sort of justify the fact that we're all kind of ensnared in this kind of trap of having to...
As I said, you know, the term selling out,
yeah.
Which I considered an honorific when I was growing up. I mean, the opposite. Not selling out was an honorific. Selling out was a terrible thing to do. I think the paradoxes of the term selling out have collapsed, and so you see people not even recognizing what that means.
Yeah.
You see, and I don't. Now I'm going to start sounding like an old fuddy-duddy, but it's not really a term that people really use or judge themselves by. They see it as a compliment. Oh, I got, you know, Doritos to use my content that I created, even though I'm just a fanboy, you know, or I got the latest hip hop artist to use my remix and in an advertisement. I'm so great. So I think one of the reasons this document may hold appeal is because it's a smart, well-heeled person kind of explaining what a lot of people are experiencing every day and a kind of trying and addressing their lingering, if there is any lingering doubt, is this a problem that I don't even have this lodestone of selling out, not selling out anymore,
yeah.
you know?
When do you think that the notion of selling out became When do you think its stigma was sort of deflated? I mean, this is probably the last, like, 10 years, would you say?
It feels that way to me. I mean, I wrote a book in 2000. It came out in 2003.
Branded. Yes.
And that, to me, was like, I didn't even know it then, but I felt like, I mean, I just was seeing all these adolescents who, I called it self-branding, who were defining themselves by the products they were consuming, like, I am Coke, I am Pepsi, I am Abercrombie. And I thought to myself, wow, this is just a teen thing. But then the more I looked into it, I was like, well, no, and these kids are growing up. And they're going to similarly retain that kind of identification. So I think a lot of it happened in the 90s. It happened with the consolidation of corporations. It happened with the faltering economy. So people didn't feel like they had the courage necessarily, even if they wanted to not define themselves by status markers. So I think there's a multitude of factors that went into it.
You think people wanted to belong and not really finding an absolute group, they turned to what corporations had to offer? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just a surround sound kind of culture where there was this, like, I mean, it is right now that we live in a screen culture where there's endless pop-up ads, where our data is being mined, where if I check out a jacket on a site, I'll be seeing that jacket, you know, reappearing endlessly on my browser, you know, with every site I visit. And in the early 2000s, when I wrote Branded, the line between advertorial and editorial in teen publications was collapsing, and that itself was a cause for dismay in media, you know, critic circles. And I wrote about it. Oh no, that, you know, this is they're getting these advertising giveaways that are masquerading as magazines for teenagers. Now it's like everything they read is carries promotional content. So, you know, magazines themselves are promotional entities. There's just, again, the paradoxes of what selling out means have collapsed. And given the difficulties of the magazine and newspaper businesses right now, people don't even focus on this that much. You know, what content carries a commercial valence and which doesn't.
But there was a time, like, I think, for example, of OK Soda, where Coca-Cola hired Dan Clowes and Charles Burns to make sort of this hip kind of design. I love this story. And they basically took the money and ran. I mean, there used to be a more honorable way of taking corporate money and basically sort of pissing in their face.
Well, I think what you're talking about is subversion or subvertising. Remember all those terms that people used to use? And I loved. They don't seem to be around so much anymore. You know, remember there's all that moment, well, it starts with Mad Magazine, but ad parodies.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even see ad parodies anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There used to be a rich culture in the 90s and even in the early noughts. I mean, they were still, I think, flourishing even after September 11th, but I think something happened. And I guess I'm trying to ask you,
what happened?
Alyssa, what was it? I mean, it probably, as you say, was post-2008 economic problems.
Economic problems. Also, I mean, 9/11 is a pertinent moment because you saw, you know, our president telling us to go shopping.
Yeah.
You saw it wasn't like, you know, have courage, batten down the hatches. It was, you know, go to the mall.
Yeah.
This is the way to be American. And that was just one of many data points on that journey towards, you know, becoming an American shopper, not an American citizen.
One thing you didn't really write about in this book that I think is possibly germane to this conversation is Tumblr. I mean, here is a situation where people think they're being alternative on Tumblr, and very often I see that they're actually tailoring their posts so that they can be liked or favorited and reposted elsewhere. And then on top of that, we had Yahoo recently purchase Tumblr, and they've started to quash down on certain blogs that actually have sexual content. And some of the, who I call them the Tumblrettes, the people who work at Tumblr, they scurry away when anybody has sort of, I suppose, a more outsider or traditionally pugnacious reply in response to a cultural ill. I mean, you know, so why do you think, do you think that sometimes mediums such as Tumblr enable the worst impulses?
I mean, I think, if we're talking about companies buying other company, I mean, we see that all the time, right? We're seeing Goodreads being bought by Amazon. Every time there's like I guess in the 90s, they would have called it mini majors. Remember when independent studios were being bought, Miramax, you know, or Sony would purchase an independent independent company. Well, you see that happening a lot with companies that would be offering alternative platforms that then would be bought by companies that don't offer those platforms. And then what happens, I guess, is eventually there's like a neutralization of content. Yeah. So that's other ways in which outsiderdom is controlled.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but, you know, I think people have a choice to limit themselves or put themselves into a position where some moderating force is going to discourage them from truly expressing what's on their mind. You know, and I'm wondering, you know, clearly there is something to be said about people's choice of expression. I mean, they're consenting to this. It's not just evil corporate forces. And then I'm wondering, you know, why.
Well, that's
that
the thing.
Is.
I mean, like, I think in the past, you know, you used to see science fiction movies where people's souls would be, you know, sucked out of their bodies by, you know, foreign or by alien beings. And now, you know, we give away our information for the price of, for a $5 badge online, for a sale item, for, you know, like, there's just such a level, I guess, of, in a certain way, I call it the flat self. I mean, this isn't in my book, but it's something that I see a lot. And I guess is one of the incentives for writing a book like this for people who are less flat. But people willing to give away their information, their data, and, you know, even the reaction to the fact that our information is being obtained against our will by all these companies and by our government, people are like, eh? You know?
Yeah.
Like, sure. Like, I'd give that away for, you know, 10% off, you know?
Well, what would be, like, the typical flat self, or, I suppose, a pernicious flat self, since we're on this particular metaphor? I mean, it seems to me it's kind of an evolution of sort of the dyed hair craze of, like, people. As I grew up in San Francisco and Berkeley, you'd see people with dyed hair, and they all look alike, possibly more alike than a sea of corporate navy blue suits, you know?
Well, there's lots of ways to be flat.
Sure.
But I guess what we're talking about here is people who have, in some ways, you know, just succumbed who are afraid and have succumbed to just a commercialized and self that doesn't have much of interior life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you don't think you have much of interior life, the only thing you're afraid of is if you've done anything wrong that people would see. You don't really care about protecting the nature of your subjectivity. That's not something that you're concerned about.
A lack of interior life is possibly part of this problem?
Perhaps, or a lack of interior life that you care about preserving.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, isn't
so
that,
privacy is important, and privacy is a component to this.
Yeah. I think without privacy, we don't know who we could be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We could be, it's sort of like the teenager who's afraid that her parent will go through her journal and see who she is, so she never writes in the journal, say, or he never writes in the journal. Well, who would we be if we don't, if we think, we always already think someone's watching us.
Yeah.
Well, we may not never know.
On the other hand, there is an exhibitionistic impulse among, say, 4chan and among Facebook and Tumblr, which we were mentioning. I mean, you know, people want to basically share every aspect of themselves to the point where sometimes, in the case of Marie Calloway, their pseudonyms are not especially patchable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like now the impulse is to overshare.
God, that was such a bizarre.
Yeah.
I did go down that rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah. But maybe a way of also approaching this and getting off Marie Calloway is to talk about the relationship between the professional and the amateur, which I feel is also important, and you actually bring up in your chapter on craft, where you also document the rise of Etsy. What was once identified in the early 20th century as anti-modern dissent by T.J. Jackson Lears, as you say, has now transformed into a marketplace where, well, you can be a featured seller on Etsy. At least one Slate writer, as you point out in the book, has called this a false feminist fantasy. But I'm wondering, you know, what makes the featured sellers on Etsy any different? I mean, Julie Schneider told you that her work had more meaning than the anonymous big box store. But I'm wondering, do you think that, you know, retailing behemoths like Etsy are able to get away with participating in this sort of stealth capitalistic wish fulfillment because the craft people really are trying to find their own physical space, that physical space that is devised in the real world can be easily taken over by, I suppose, the inside aspect of Etsy or some other online entity like Amazon.
So I love the complexity of your question, but like, what is a quicker way, just so I can get this question in my head easier?
What is the difference between a craftsperson who relies on Etsy and, you know, say, someone who goes into a store? I mean, is there really any genuine state of rebellion.
Oh, and, I see. Because yeah. it's not... well, I think the claim that some of the... It wasn't just on Etsy. The crafters yeah. I spoke to were making is just knowing where your stuff comes from and knowing that a human being made it and not a exploited worker or a machine or, you know, some combination thereof that, you know, is enough and is its own form of resistance and that the handmade has a status that we should all, you know, relish. So I think that that's true, too. So it's not just the Etsy as a authentic bazaar, yeah. but it's the Etsyan as an authentic maker, right? So I think that's the resistance claim they're making. And I try to problematize it. I mean, I say like, look, yeah, you know, many people are not breaking even at this.
Yeah.
It has its own exploitative potential. And obviously, again, Etsy, I think, I don't remember right now what's going on with them, but as a corporation, but they're most likely at this point, probably decrafting for all I know and becoming just a total corporate entity. You know, yeah. I mean, this as we were just discussing, I mean, I don't want to say anything libelous, but because I haven't reported on this lately, but they could well be doing that, right? So,
yeah. You can say things libelous. I'll provide a disclaimer if you.
So I just don't know. I haven't yeah. reported on it lately. But all I'm saying is, yeah, but the impulse that the crafters have, I do think has some outsider elements. I think some of the people trying, and this brings me back to like why I say included these crafters in a book with people who others might find more truly outside, like people who are proudly insane. Why would I include the crafters who seem more humdrum? Because it's a continuum. It's
yeah.
a continuum where I try to start with some of the more difficult outsiders, you know, the more, I guess, to my mind, again, authentic outsiders, and then went down the line to people who are just rebelling in ways that we all recognize. So
I'm wondering if this notion of Etsy and homespun craftsmanship is kind of almost a precursor to what we're now seeing with freemium games, of which the other night I became temporarily addicted to Candy Crush Saga before I realized it was a grand racket and promptly uninstalled it from my phone, realizing that it's actually playing on my impatience because once you are done with the lives, you have to wait every 30 minutes for a new life, or if you don't want to wait, you pay 99 cents for it. And I'm like, wow, this is one of the most venal rackets I've seen
oh, yeah.
in a long time. You know, Team Fortress 2, same thing.
I just was reading an economist who was claiming that Netflix, which we all are hoping it's going to be, again, like we're
yeah.
talking about independent film to begin with, is going to be this new place for independent voices,
yeah.
is actually, this was his claim, a giant scheme to get to mine entertainment data, users' entertainment data, like
yeah.
what are people really liking? It's just basically just a giant, you know, test market.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, these things are so ambiguous, and I was hoping that this book sort of touched on that and kind of got that across. And I from your questions, I feel like it probably did. So I'm
yeah.
glad about that.
Well,
yeah.
I'm happy to unpack this further. I mean,
yeah.
you know, it seems to me that perhaps the freemium games and things like Netflix are playing with our notion of what it is to be an outsider. It's like we're empowered and we get put into this state of this narcotic state of enjoyment when in fact we are falling into this inside trap, and then we become just as much of a dope as anybody who's, you know, going to Las Vegas. And so, you know, I mean, how do they continue to get us, Alyssa? That's what I want to know.
Well, I think, you know, there's some, I forget who said it, but there is no outside, right? That's
yeah.
There is no outside to capitalism. There's no outside to the world that we live in. What I wanted to look for, thus, were people who I thought were living ideas, that these were almost philosophical communities. So
yeah.
the crafters, for all their potential pitfalls, are a philosophical community. The vegan activists of various stripes are
yeah.
philosophical communities, let's say plural, because they all come at it in a different way. And I really thought that, you know, and even the people who are trying to change what it means to be a fan and what it means to be a star have a philosophy of a kind.
Yeah, but to get to the vegans, I mean, and to also offer a very provocative question to you, you point out that a lot of these vegans, they're very interested in creating fake meat, and the option there is, well, you have to watch all these slaughterhouse videos to show how evil it is to to basically butcher an animal. On the other side of the fence, and by the way, I speak as a carnivore, and I speak as someone who also eats veggie burgers, so I have really no stake in the fight. But I think that it's in some ways just as sanctimonious as a supermarket chain, which insists that it's being more moral in the way that it slaughters animals and says, hey, we're actually the guardian of decency, and you can actually go ahead and purchase the beef here. I mean, you know, to me, I don't really see much of a distinction in this sort of sanctimonious ideology in which I'm supposed to be a better person or I'm supposed to trust in the other person who's providing the meat, you know, in order for me to be a better person. I mean, it's all playing on that exact same trap. And I'm wondering, you know, what makes one better than the other? Or, you know, maybe this shows how something that starts initially like veganism as an outlier idea is inevitably going to become just as problematic as any kind of mainstream ideology.
Yeah, well, I mean, I picked the animal rights counterpublic as an example in the book and as a sort of example of co-optation to some extent because yeah. it's one of the most fully internalized outsider groups in the book.
Yeah.
For the very reason you're saying. I mean, Whole Foods has its animal cruelty diktat, and it tells you, I joke, it's like a Geneva Convention
yeah.
for animals, like, you know, what level of pain these various, you know, pigs or cows have experienced. And then you have people who have gone to prison to defend the rights that
yeah.
I've interviewed. I interviewed someone who was an animal rights activist who cried when a field mouse died.
Yeah.
And then I talked to an animal rights lawyer who had to listen to people barking at him when he entered a courtroom for years. You know, so. And then there are people who are just trying to sell some fake meat in a health food store. So,
to say nothing of genetically engineered meat, which
yeah.
is now a big thing.
Right,
these days.
That's the end of that chapter.
Yeah.
I call them animal rights futurists.
Yes.
So there's like layers not only of co-optation and acceptance, like, look, you'd be hard pressed to find foie gras in any restaurant. This is a movement that has worked on that level,
yeah.
right? And then you find things that really haven't worked yet. I mean, you still don't have a huge animal rights law. I mean, it's moved more to the center than when I even started the book, but it's not as active a movement as I would like.
But I think in presenting the example of vegans and animal rights, you get into a rare kind of prescriptive quality that is just not there in the other dichotomies you present in the book. I mean, I'm wondering if prescription is one of the reasons why some of these movements eventually fizzle out and become sort of mainstream tropes, as
prescription?
Opposed. Yeah, prescription, prescribing what people should do. You
I
know,
see.
How people should eat. I mean, being very
I see.
Morally ostentatious about it.
Well, I think one of the things, and this is why I use the term self-co-optation,
yeah.
I mean, one of the things is when people recognize that linking people's consumer choice to an alternative viewpoint is very powerful. So when Whole Foods sees that it's going to, you know, be able to sell a product and consumers see they're going to be able to enjoy a product supposedly without guilt, then that's going to be something that's more functional than just somebody saying, let's free all the animals in labs, because no one, you know, that's not something ordinary people feel like they can participate in or really want to participate in. So the element of self-cooptation is something I argue across all these communities is part of what we're talking about here, like what the 90s wrought, what the end of the fear of selling out wrought, is that the really effective outsiders are those who recognize that they have to prepare themselves for co-optation rather than just be co-opted by another force beyond
yeah.
themselves.
It sounds very much like orientation meetings before you actually get the job. You know?
Yeah.
I want to actually talk about the Icarus Project. It's this culmination of web-organized outside of groups. You have bipolar and schizophrenic people who have organized themselves into mad pride activists. They protest against excessive medication and diagnosis. And they also point to other countries who employ people with mental problems. But there's a fine line, as we know, being writers, between being eccentric or individual and in need of real help. There are several writers I know who are, in fact, bipolar and whose behavior is embraced in the literary community. I mean, what risks are there to being part of something like Mad Pride? Do they view any treatment as acceptable? Is there any alliance that they can form with inside institutions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want people to get the sense that the Icarus Project is against medication,
yeah.
per se. I mean, I'd say more than half of its members are on medication.
Yeah.
They just question diagnoses, and some of them do question medication, and I think they're right to. I mean, I don't think they're right to question it in a blanket way, but I think every patient should say, is this the right cocktail for me? I talked to this one young woman, Christine Chapman, who was given the wrong diagnosis, and she indeed needed medication, but she was told she had one condition, and she actually had another, and she was being medicated for that condition. And what a group like the Icarus Project did was she would be going to meetings, and these would all be peer-led, sort of, again, outsider meetings. This wasn't on, her psychiatrist didn't think of this. And they were saying these other people who had suffered from similar, they don't call them diseases, they call them extreme states.
Yeah.
This sounds like X or Y to me. This resembles when I had this condition, not that, and or this extreme state, not that.
It wasn't a drunken imbroglio. It was an extreme state.
It was extreme. Yeah.
It's a good loophole.
But they, you know, and then she was able to get the right diagnosis, the right medication. She still went to meetings.
Yes.
I'd like everybody to have great healthcare, great medication, but the likelihood is, I mean, if we have 5 million people in America say they don't even get adequate treatment, and half of them because they can't afford it, maybe all they're going to have is a group like the Icarus Project available to them.
Well, I mean, you know, aside from even, let's just say that everybody was, well, I mean, as Obamacare gets worked out, let's just say that everybody has all the best healthcare in the world. I mean, pie in the sky, but let's just say for the sake of argument. I mean, you know, is it the outsider's function to still rail against that in some sense? I mean, you know, is it the Icarus Project's mandate to just sort of constantly remain in this position of skepticism, to constantly resist? I mean, it gets really interesting when you start thinking about, well, what is really your obligation as an outsider, especially in a group like that?
I guess so. I mean, I think their deepest commitment is to reframing their condition more than defying psychiatrists or something. I mean, it's just, as far as a psychiatrist might say to them, you know, you are suffering from a debilitating disease that will mean that you're, you know, 50% more likely to have suicidal thoughts and you're this and you're that and this is what the DSM-5 says you are, they'd say, no, that's not true. I have a dangerous gift and I have this state that needs to be treated. So, I don't know. I guess I know that they may seem extreme from the outside, but when you listen to them, and I hope this comes across in the book, like some of them may potentially, you know, just resist for its own sake, but I think a lot of them are really just trying to reframe mental illness, and that's a real uphill battle right now. We live in an incredibly diagnostic, happy country, yet people don't get the help they need, so it's like this weird combination where everybody's being told they're X or Y, but they're not being then given regular appointments with so I can't imagine that Obamacare is going to be changing that. And that's the role that peer counseling, and it's not just the Icarus Project, it's the recovery movement in general. It's I talked to other people at other peer group counseling, and I mean, recently I just happened to visit a farm in Massachusetts where they had psychiatric people in psychiatric care, you know, getting...
That's them right now.
Yeah, exactly. Getting help, whatever, in a non-traditional setting. So I think there's going to be room for this no matter how good healthcare gets, although I really doubt it will get good enough to help all the people that need it.
Sure. I wanted to bring up transphobia and some of the transfeminists you deal with in this book. I mean, there were some recent concerns about transphobia and hate speech expressed by Philip Sandifier in relation to Chelsea Manning. Wikipedia won't actually allow her real name to be published. It's now listed under Bradley Manning. Also, of course, there's...
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is... I can send you the link. It's really fascinating.
That is terrible.
Yeah, it is really terrible. I mean, you met with...
Well, that's like outsider on outsider.
That is outsider on outsider. But, you know, you met with a number of trans feminists, including Julia Serrano, who brought up the assumption of a woman's choice to have or not have children as a reason for why these distinctions are important. We recently also saw the Solidarities for White Women hashtag that was pointing to the fact that some of the more mainstream feminists are really not thinking about these broader implications, that it doesn't just fit the neat category of white feminists. And these are, obviously, with this example I just mentioned about Wikipedia and Bradley Chelsea Manning, it's pretty clear that, you know, we kind of, you know, you kind of have to open up the floodgates to other viewpoints. I guess my question is why do you think that mainstream feminism has such a difficult time wrapping its head around non-white or transgender points of views? I mean, you know, do you think that there's this insular aura that tends to wrap itself around any outsider movement if it just continues to germinate, or what?
Well, I have to say, I can't say anything about all feminism.
Sure,
like,
sure.
I think, I think feminism, again, I'm going to be PC here, but it has to have an S at the end, yeah. Feminisms, right?
Yes.
So,
sure.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there was a second wave understanding of it, right?
Yeah,
that it
yeah.
was going to be, it's a movement to, for parity and equal pay for women, for gender, you know, new and expanded gender possibilities for women, not for trans women, not for gender nonconforming people. I do think that there's been a push lately, and trans feminism is part of it, to something more, I guess this is that terrible word, intersectional, which would mean a kind of combining lots of different kinds of politics
sure.
within feminism and not just saying, like, it's just feminism. But I think you're right. I mean, I think people get polarized, and part of what I was looking for, again, with these, whoever I was including in these philosophical communities, where they were able to have that level of hybridity, where they'd be able to bring new things together into the mix, and it wasn't just, you know, classic feminism or something, but it was like, oh, look, this is a really, the forefront, I think, of feminism is to see all gender biases as connected and not just bias against women. Now, this has gotten, I mean, my case study was this college student at Barnard who, and this has happened in other instances as well, who came in, it was a women's school, and he was trans, and there's a lot of, like, confusion at first in the institution about what to do with him. He wound up transferring to Columbia, and I do think since I first met him, this was 2007, things have really changed. There's been a lot of debate in schools, and so, I mean, I don't know if that's coming from feminism, but that's coming from at least a younger, there is, I think this is one way which a younger generation is better.
Yeah,
I really do.
Yeah,
like, we're talking
yeah.
about people who don't understand selling out, and I was heartened by the kind of intelligence around what feminism should mean from people who are like 21 years old.
Yeah. Well, there was that study recently that I think something in the area of 70-80% of people under the age of 20 are really concerned with privacy. I mean, you know, things like, you know, Snapchat, of course, show a clear concern for this. But this may actually play into what you're talking about. I've sort of long hypothesized that because the millennial generation, they went through school and they didn't get jobs, they kind of have developed this safe approach because they have student debts to actually pay. But you have this generation below them that is about to go through college, and they see what they've gone through, and they say, well, you know what? Maybe we can throw a few Molotovs. Maybe we could actually prepare for this by protecting ourselves so that we don't get screwed like our older sisters and older brothers did.
Well, but I do think in the case of trans feminism, other things like that, there yeah. are spaces just where there's been discourse around it, that these were 21-year-olds who went to college where people
sure.
were talking about this. And some of it's like a lack of education in a sense,
yeah.
you know, like, so, you know, you talk to women in their 50s or 60s and these may be new ideas to them. You know, I mean, some of it's just habituation. I mean, again, it's like the outsiders moving, get mainstreaming,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so this
yeah,
is
yeah.
was once an outsider idea that's going through the process. So I guess the final stage will be like in 10 years when we're like, of course, trans feminism, you know?
Yeah. Well, 10 years ago, it's the same thing with same-sex marriage. So, you know, it's a slow process.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually bring up something that is not in your book again, but that is actually, I think, very...
I like that you're generating all this stuff. It's
well,
like, okay,
your,
soda.
Your
I mean...
book, your book. Well, the okay soda just kind of came to mind, but your book kind of has my brain thinking. But I recently read this post in a site called the Comics Alliance that actually had two people reviewing this new...
Oh, so you like the cover, eh? Josh Neufeld.
Ah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, but it had two people who were reviewing this sci-fi show airing on the sci-fi called Heroes of Cosplay. Now, cosplay to me is extremely interesting simply because it's the professionalization of fans who are dressing up in costumes for various science fiction and fantasy
shows. Is it
like
SK kind of thing? Or?
I mean, no, but it's different because before people, you know, would just show up to like science fiction conventions and there'd be this kind of ramshackle approach. Oh, that kind of looks a little bit like Captain Kirk's tunic or, you know, or whatever. But now they're really concerned with getting it right. But what's especially interesting about cosplay is that it's moved away from something that was initially, I suppose, ridiculed or celebrated, depending upon where you were, such as the schlubby Tron guy from a few years ago. Remember him, where he was this fat guy, and he was wearing the Tron outfit, and he was kind of became a sort of token of geek. But now, in this particular post, they were talking about how, like, the body images are moving more and more closer to the kind of Hollywood stars and everything, and that the show is kind of promulgating this as well. And not only that, but you also have this one cosplayer named Yara Hurry. She's become this weird fan idol who basically is making money exclusively from cosplay, and she's perpetuating almost this false notion of profit and attention from fandom. That's not unlike what we were talking about with Etsy, and that is actually not dissimilar from the fame impulse that we saw with American Idol and so forth. So, you know, I mean, I'm wondering how much imitation like this plays into the kind of insider-outsider notion. I mean, you know, what are your thoughts on how something like cosplay or...
Where, like, the fan world is, like, a miniaturized version
yes,
of the celebrity world.
Yes, exactly.
Like,
or becomes almost put on the same standing as yeah. the people who create the art.
The one difference, though, is who's getting paid.
Yeah.
And who's getting highlighted, sure. who's getting promoted. Like, so there's still, like... I mean, for all the rise of the outsiders, and I try to get at this paradox, especially yeah. in my music and film chapters,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes, yes.
Where, yeah, the fans and the stars, the lines between them, philosophically and intellectually, the lines between them are dissolving, but monetarily, and in terms of who gets the strokes for it, who gets, the, you know, who gets promoted, who gets actual, like, celebrity of any duration, we really, the stars are still pretty much fixed. So, I mean, it's really interesting. There is all this generation of amateur content. Sometimes that amateur content jumps over the line, you know. I wrote about somebody, I interviewed people at Vimeo
yeah.
who were producing all these videos, and there was one guy who did like a time-lapse video that somebody out of the ether offered him like $100,000 to
yeah,
make a film version.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
And, you know, I'm sure there are stories that I haven't even touched upon, and there's, you know, I talked to these Vimeo auteurs where they're like a million hits for like after, you know within a couple days
yeah.
when they're shooting somebody on a broken subway step. So you have that, you have visibility, you have amateurs creating content, you have amateurs in a parallel world to stars, but then you still have this exploitation. I don't if it's not by the stars themselves, it's by corporations who are raiding the amateur content and reusing it, and who use people's images now, you know, that started happening, you know, against their will, you know, use their data again. So it's just, it is a very murky territory, a lot of ambiguity.
Well, to jump off of that particular movie chapter, I mean, with Beasts of the Southern Wild and the Star Wars Uncut project, you also point to the fact that a lot of these efforts are collective in nature. And it's not unlike, to some degree, the collective crowd that emerged around the Occupy movement. But in comparing this to the independent filmmakers of the 1960s, people like John Cassavetes and so forth, I mean, yes, those early movies that we're talking about were initially defined by their collective approach and then became distinct individual expressions of cinema and all that. But, you know, we're also talking about something where in both cases, and you also bring up the Kenneth Lonergan film, Margaret, I mean, critics or tastemakers of some sort are still a part of actually giving credence to this outsider art. But to actually complicate this dilemma further, I mean, if you have an amateur republic of tastemakers, I mean, well, much like socialism, they're going to become corrupted by avarice. They're going to be corrupted by greed, the entitled fan critic advocate. This is also what is happening. And this is, I think, a little bit different from the, I suppose, designated gatekeeper who said, hey, John Cassavetes, you got to check him out. You got to support him. I mean, you know, I guess to try to basically bring this massive question into an actual inquiry. I mean, if the Star Wars movies have taught us anything, republics do not last forever. So what's the limitation of, say, a collective filmmaking movement of today, and how does this compare to the independent filmmaking we've seen in the past?
Well, that's a question close to my heart. I was originally a film critic, so it probably shows through in this chapter. I definitely think that there's less auteurism, although there's exceptions, obviously, you know, within independent film, that there's more modesty. I mean, you see Mumblecore and you see a lot of other independent film movements, as well as Court 13, who I read about, who did Beasts of Southern Wild.
Yes.
Community-based work. I mean, the strong thing about Cassavetes and some of that work. I mean, although that also was, you know, he was relying on the same actors, Gina Rowlands and
yes.
Ben Gazzara.
And Peter Falk.
And himself.
And he had to take roles in Hollywood movies in order to actually get his movies made as well.
Right. I mean, the thing that if you contrast it with, you know, Beasts of the Southern Wild and Mumblecore. And,
yeah.
I mean, I think the difference is less the terms of production than the affect. Because, I mean, the thing that strikes me about something like Mumblecore is that they make films that where people express less emotion than they do in real life,
yeah,
rather than
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
So it's like, or we're
almost inert too.
Where life is more less troubling and more modest, and less bad things happen in a Mumblecore movie than they do in real life. Like no one ever dies. Like
yeah.
there's no illness. There's no aging. You know, there's no real betrayal.
Talk about a flat self.
Yeah. No, it's kind of interesting. Yeah. You know, and so that's one of the risks, I think. But that's more of an aesthetic thing. I'm just trying to think about this question, what's lost. I mean, I went back and looked at some of the old newsreel films, and there were a lot of documentary collectives in the 60s. So there's precursors for this. I think those collectives were more political. I mean, that's one of the distinctions. Some of these collectives, like even Court 13, I mean, they have a politics of inclusion and of using amateurs rather than professional actors, and then also like doing site-specific filming in New Orleans, and you could read that film as a you know, fabulistic about Katrina, etc. But they're not explicitly political like some of the collective work was in the 60s.
But even the most political films, the films that actually end up in the books, still require the tastemakers, and still require the critics, and still require the advocates. So can you cite an example of a truly outsider film that somehow managed to skirt this particular line?
I guess Star Wars Uncut also needed advocates, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, I mean, it had its advocates because, I mean, this goes back to Amanda Palmer, but it had participant advocates. So if you're actually participating, or if you're actually ponying up some money, like, okay, I'll kick into your Kickstarter campaign, you then, from a behavioral economic standpoint, almost have a vested interest to become an advocate. So maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe that's where we're moving into.
Yeah, well, then you'd have these entirely crowdsourced films.
Yeah.
Which could be, I mean, and then we go back to the question of affect, politics, quality. You know, we go back to sort of classic questions about late modernism, like, do, you know, what happens when we don't have a unified subjectivity?
Yeah.
What happens when things are... when we don't have a unified politics, you know.
Yeah.
So as someone who has late modernist tastes and 21st century desires to see the crowd involved in everything, it's a dilemma.
Yeah. Huh. Well, maybe this might seem a great time to kind of bring this conversation to a close to talk about what a true outsider really is. I mean, you talk to this guy at Sublime Frequencies, Alan Bishop, and he says, I want to turn other people on to the things I like, rather than the things that other people like, for the world to be influenced by what I personally like. So going to this question of Gatekeeper, that to me seems a fairly sensible position. I mean, he will only be influenced by the tastes and the sensibilities that he cultivates. That is truly an independent and outsider choice. And the fact that he's so self-disciplined to stick with that for his entire career is really admirable. He's probably influenced in some small way, but he's so determined to live up to his tastes that maybe this is kind of the model for where we're supposed to move in order to, I suppose, be unsullied by corporate.
Well, yeah. Well, then we become. I mean, for a while, in my book, I was going to try to explore this, like how so much. I mean, not selling out becomes a question of taste making, which yeah. then you know you see like kind of. At some point, I was thinking of putting Pitchfork in the book because of that, but then Pitchfork started to seem problematic
to me. But
then
it grew as
yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
mushrooms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it got too big. But taste is the last recourse in a world with too much information and too much culture, both celebrity and specialized and amateur. So, yeah, you see somebody like the Sublime Frequencies guy, who, by the way, is often curating other people's work
yes.
and creating something new with it.
And that's a word we haven't talked about because, you know, Maria Popova also says, I'm a curator, as opposed to a blogger. So they take on this label of curator almost as an outsider label, which I find fascinating because we previously associated that with museums or libraries. We previously associated that with, like, you know, hollow institutions that were very insiders. So that's also quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's part of it. It's part of when you have this wild and woolly world of outsiders, insiders, amateurs, professionals, fans, stars, people with extreme ideas being able to express them, people with really banal ideas being able to express them over and over again. Then, the curator becomes this enshrined position that, and the curator is no longer always an insider. So that's what's interesting. I guess this Align Frequencies guy, Alan Bishop, is a stand-in for that.
Yeah.
For the curator and the Margaret bloggers too, for the curators who are not insiders.
Yeah.
Curators were once always insiders.
So do you think that in appreciating culture we have an obligation to be outsider in some way, that we can't just feed our tastes with insider stuff? But, you know, then this leads me to also present things like NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour, or even more ignobly, Slate Culture Gab Fest, where they go on and talk about this insidery culture in fine meanings and often discuss it in a misinformed and superficial way, in my humble opinion. So what is the way to obviate this? I mean, you know, should we kind of step outside and live on the wild side?
I think it's really important for people to have data streams, and that's a word Lev Manovich, who's a theorist I really love, talks about. So, where data streams, which are just not the typical Twitter feed, which was once the typical news feed, whatever, that is not just what's on cable, that's not just the book of the hour, you know, how many parties do you go to where everyone wants to talk about what's in the New Yorker this week, you know, I mean, at least in New York, that's what happens. But, you know, I'd love to go to a party where all anyone's reading is like early 19th century novels. That, you know, I really like when talking to people who've devoted themselves to some specialization that's out of time, out of the traditional slipstream. So you can either do it in your own era, or you can go to some other point in history. You can go to another country. Just get out of the obvious sources of information and culture.
On the other hand, when you look at, like, niches on Twitter, I mean, film critics, just talk to film critics on Twitter.
I mean, though.
Yeah.
What I mean is, don't just get your information and your culture from acceptable sources, so-called acceptable. Like, and I know you agree with me.
I agree. But
I think that's more important than ever.
But there's still this troubling problem, and New York media types talk to New York media types. Some books people on Twitter will not read nonfiction and will only want to talk about books. Same goes for any subculture, especially on Twitter. You follow the people you want to follow, and then you're not keeping yourself wide enough in terms of variegated interests and all that. I mean, you know, so it leads me to wonder if we can even persuade people to live up to that sort of a little outsider here, a little wild stuff there. You know, you can like your comfort stuff as well, but it does help to actually, like, you know, just to keep you alive, to waver just a little bit outside your comfort zone from time to time.
Yeah, I absolutely think it's important to do that. And I mean, I attempt to do that myself, and I feel disappointed that in myself that I'm always looking at the Times like everybody else. And I mean, I'm glad I'm looking at the Times and not even more crappy stuff, I guess. But you know, I'm watching HBO or something like, and I'm like, look, I should be out there, you know, gathering strange videos. And then I sort of force myself to do that because I like what it does to my mind. I'm like, this is the promise that the web has given us.
Yeah.
That, you know, I can very quickly go and find a novel from the 1960s that's been, you know, out of print and read it on my Kindle. And I can very quickly go find an old video that isn't even out on Criterion yet, you know, from a Polish filmmaker from the 60s or 70s. And I can have that in my head rather than just, like, the immediate realities in front of me.
Well, I mean, there still remain enough secret, so-called secret things that have not yet been discovered by the masses that, you know, the internet allows bazillions of options on that level. But the question is what happens when something gets co-opted, when something gets discovered? And then it's like, anyway. Well, these are all a lot of fine distinctions that will probably have our listeners thinking about. I certainly hope so. Well, listen, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you for meeting me outside to discuss outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those are the outsider sounds of school children.